I'm Don Dixon, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the definitive sound series vinyl release of REM's Chronic Town and Murmur, please welcome Don Dixon and Mitch Easter. Hey guys.
Hey Pat.
Hey Don, where are you located right now?
I live in Canton, Ohio.
Canton, Ohio. And I believe, Mitch, you and I are in the same location of Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
I'm in the same county as Winston-Salem. So almost. Yeah.
Almost. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I've seen you at one of the local grocery stores in the area. So
I assume you live.
Everybody eats.
You bet.
All right. Before we start, Don, do you have a social media presence? Where can my listeners find you on the World Wide Web?
I would prefer them not to find me, so I will maintain my Thomas Pynchon style
anonymity.
Yes.
All right. What about you, Mitch? Can people find you out there on the socials?
I'm easy to find. I think there's an Instagram thing of me. I'm Mitch Easter. I think that's there. And there's a Let's Active site that's up here on there every now and then, yeah.
All right. People listening, the Definitive Sound Series vinyl, a one-time pressing limited to 3,000 units. You can pre-order it right now. I believe it ships on the 9th of January. Again, only 3,000 units are going to be pressed. So if you haven't pre-ordered, what are you waiting for? We got Mitch now.
Hey.
Hello, sir.
I think most people are waiting for the bank to approve their loan so they can afford this record.
Yeah.
It's a tad pricey. And that brings up a question. When a release like this comes out, are you two guys seeing any money from this? Will there be any mailbox money coming your way? Oh, there's laughter.
I mean, in theory, I think, but you know, I don't know. You never know anymore. All right. I don't think any of the people involved here are not to ruin us, but it's a convoluted scene.
Oh yeah, no. Everybody is lovely that is making this, and they're making it for all the right reasons. And the record really does sound fantastic. And but you know, there's no dough in music. You know that.
I do know it, but I do know it for new artists. I was hoping that you veteran guys would have made some cool deals and seeing some mailbox money.
We don't have any control over this, right? I mean, we don't own this master. We don't have any control over where it goes or who licenses it or anything. So, you know, it's possible that there will be quarters, not even pennies, actual quarters showing up at some point, but I'm not counting on it.
All right. So, Don, you're not going to go out and buy a new car.
I need a new car, but it will not be because of this record coming out.
All right. This one's for Mitch. When you got your copies of this new release, did you feel like this is the best the vinyl has ever sounded?
Yeah. Yeah. It sounded really good. I've been kind of a skeptic about all the things people get excited about with 180 gram and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't really correlate to anything sonically. I mean, it suggests it's a, you know, good pressing, but you never know. But this is notably good. And it's not like it's remastered or it's changed. It's like, wow, this is particularly good. Just like, I don't know, like a meal you've had before. It's the same flavors, but it's clearer. It's just nice. You know, it's just good. So it's real.
All right. And Don, what about you? Same thing?
Exactly the same thing. It's just, if anything, it's less messed with. So, I mean, it sounds like pretty much what we created in the studio, and that's hard for vinyl to get to sound this sort of detailed in the way it's detailed.
All right. Why are people so precious with the handling of their vinyl currently? Everyone that buys a new vinyl release, when I was a teenager, we'd throw the thing across the room, we'd put it on, it sounded great. Now everyone's so precious with it.
Well, they're $125 is one of the reasons.
Okay, that's a good
$99 when I started buying them. I've always been careful with my records. Beatles mono Beatles album I bought or whatever soul looks brand new, and it's been played 400 times.
All right,
fantastic. I would say I'm kind of in the middle on that. You know, as a kid, my parents threw away those inner sleeve things immediately. It's just sort of
right, yeah.
But nevertheless, we didn't trample them. You know, when I play records from the old family Magnavox, they actually do sound fine. The thing about vinyl records is that they are sort of tough. I mean, we were programmed originally to ignore, you know, little flaws in them. So, you know, they accumulate a bit of that, but they're actually pretty tough. That's why you can go to Goodwill and get some great, you know, George Jones records, you know, but the precious thing started to me a long time ago, really before they got expensive and everything. It's kind of curious. Like everybody started putting it in those heavy plastic sleeves, you know, to protect the covers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't quite get it, but certainly nowadays you are spending some kind of real money on them. Although supposedly relative to, you know, the cost of living, they haven't really gone up as much as it appears, but they are expensive. And I like the idea of people taking care of them because they are, you know, they're an analog format. It's a spiral scratch, you know, it's susceptible to finger oils, attracting dust and all that kind of stuff. You know? So.
Yeah. And I guess the price hasn't gone up as much as concert tickets has.
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of hard to even fathom.
Yeah. I was looking at some old concert tickets last week. I had a Van Halen, I think $950.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ridiculous, but you know, so it goes.
But okay. That's still $950. What year was the Van Halen?
That was a 1981 Fair Warning tour.
Okay. So minimum wage was what? $350 in 1981.
Yeah.
Like that. So it's, Three hours of working. So that makes the equivalent of like a $45 ticket now.
Okay. All right. Although I don't think the minimum wage in North Carolina is, I think it's like $7.25. So.
No, but I mean, but a lot of people are making $15 an hour. And that's sort of.
I hope they are.
But it is true, though, that tickets have crossed into this multi-hundreds kind of thing, you know. It reminds me a little bit of paperback books. You know, they were like 35 cents, you know, and then they were 50 cents, and then they were $11.95. You know, they just made this huge leap, and it still wasn't really that much, so people just do it, you know. It was kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, if we're paying it, they'll keep charging us, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, let's do some tech questions.
All the additional, the stinking additional charges to concerts, which bothers me. Somebody pay them $300 and then they add $35 in handling and $40 to park. And it's just, you know, just that, but even not counting parking, it's just ridiculous. I agree. I think it's
And
out of control.
It's out of control. Yeah. And I don't know if there's a place you can go anymore and just buy the ticket and avoid the handling fees. Like, when I was a kid, we would go and wait at the venue or go wait at a department store that had a, you know, some type of a ticket machine that would come out and you could bypass all that stuff. But now I don't even think there's a way to do it. I think it's just built in.
What department store in Winston-Salem did you go to?
Oh, this was, I grew up in Pennsylvania. So this was.
Oh, where?
Small town, Holidaysburg, Western PA.
Okay. So near me. Out here in Canton.
Sure. Population 5,000 in my hometown growing up.
It's about mine. So where's Holidaysburg? What's it near?
It's near State College, about 45 minutes from State College.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you're a college town kid.
Well, kind of. Yeah, I guess so. That's if you know, most kids went to college there. I did not. I went to a Catholic college in Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
Latrobe, famous for Rolling Rock beer.
There you go. Now, when I was in college, we're getting off topic. I don't care, though. This is fun. when I was in college, we didn't drink the Rolling Rock beer because that was the town beer. Then I moved to Chicago after college, and I go to a bar and they're charging $7 for one. And I'm like, what? This is shit.
It's like Iron City.
Yeah. Like Iron City. Right. Mitch, feel free to jump in on the beer conversation.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I don't know. I've had some local beers really like people insisted that I have them, and I wasn't sure if it was a prank or if it was pride, you know. I'm thinking of OV in Winnipeg, and also Iron City in Pittsburgh. I mean, you know, they both tasted like beer to me, but they were given to me like, check this out, you know, and it was, you didn't know. You really didn't know what the motive was.
Some secret society of beer drinkers.
Olympia used to be up in Northern California.
Yep. And Yingling was another one in Pennsylvania.
Yingling. We drink. Yes. Yeah, Yingling. And Schlitz was made in Winston-Salem for a long time.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. If you're just tuning in, that's stupid to say. It's a podcast. We're talking about beers. Okay. So let me ask you guys some tech questions. Remastered from the very original master tapes. How do we know that's true? Like, they could tell me anything and I'd believe it, but how do we know? Where were these masters? Who owns them? How do they get them?
Do you want to answer this, Mitch? Do you have it?
We have to take the word, you know, of people for this because we weren't in California to dig them out of the vault they're supposed to have been in. But these are, you know, reputable people, as they say. And I believe they did get a hold of the real tapes. Because they're aware of such things as not the real tapes, you know, but I think, I mean, these particular records are under the purview of Universal. Am I not right there? So Universal would control access to them. Okay. And I do know from other routes that Universal will get the real tapes to people they really want to get them to. So in this case, this was a high-end project. I think they were using the actual tapes. And I can't remember the name of the mastering engineer, but you probably remember. He's a esteemed fellow in California who did this mastering. But supposedly based on what Greg Calvi did originally, and I hope that's true, I think it's believable because they kind of sound the same, these records. You know,
here's what I know. I met a guy on the street in New York named Dilly, who works for UMG as a master sleuth, and he came up to me after a concert that I had played, Town Hall, and said, I found the tapes. I found the original tapes. And I said, great. And he was talking about this project, which we were just barely aware of at that point, but were aware of. He talked to me about the notes that he had found, which were Greg's notes, because it didn't contain any, the original mix didn't contain anything specific from Mitch and me. Any of those notes would have been with the multi-tracks.
Okay.
So I was convinced at that point that they had indeed found the original tapes. And this is something that people had been trying to do off and on for a few years. So his name's Dilly, D-I-L-I. I guess
all right.
His real name is, but.
But Dilly's got all the answers, so we trust him.
And Grover, who was the captain of this whole thing, really likes him, and you know, was to me was very happy. He was able to find the tape. Said he's sort of a miracle worker in terms of finding that stuff.
All righty.
So I think I agree with Mitch. I think, and they sound like this was not a second generation version of this record.
And when they say, and Mitch, this would be for you, when they say one step all analog, tell us people that don't know any tech stuff what that means.
Well, it means that, you know, it didn't get converted to digital audio at any point, and it went from a tape to a record cutting tape machine, which is a special kind of playback machine that's for vinyl records, and it you know, is plugged right into a record cutting lathe. And then from there, the process is what they've been doing for vinyl records for years, except they've taken out some of the steps that mainly were to be able to make bigger runs on one stamper. The stamper is the thing that squishes the vinyl into a record, you know. Okay. They've eliminated a couple of steps. And what that means is that the pressing stuff is not as rigid and it wears out faster. And so they have to cut more master lacquers in the first place. And then they have to do small runs. This is impractical, in other words, for, you know, top 10 hit kind of record production. That's, you know, if they're going to do more than 3,000, they have to go back and cut more original lacquers. The lacquer is the first record cutting stage. So it's kind of inefficient, you know, but it's just like, you know how from copying cassettes or whatever, they sound a little different every time you do it. Every time you take out a step in analog transmissions, you know, you get a little closer to the source.
So back in the day when Murmur was first released on vinyl, would they have done it that way back then? Or was there
No, they did the multiple steps after the original lacquer to make stampers that would do tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Dixon, when did you first become aware of the band REM?
I knew this guy named Mitch Easter.
Heard of him? I've heard of him.
Recording them. And he had already done, before I really knew much about him, I think he'd already done the Radio Free Europe single. And he was working on, when Mitch was working on Chronic Town, you know, I listened to some stuff. We talked some about the problems that there were with the, not problems, but the nature of the sound of the band and their approach, especially to the way the low end worked and how things worked. And, you know, I listened to those multi-tracks to some of the songs, and that's how I became aware of them.
All right. And were you a fan instantly?
I was. I immediately appreciated the differences about what they were and the kind of fun that the music had. I mean, the music was especially, I think, Chronic Town is just a lot of fun.
And Mitch, did the band find you or did you find them?
I know that they found me, but it was a recommendation from Peter Holzapfel, who you probably know. He had met them because they were staying in his apartment in New York, and I don't know how they were connected with him and his apartment, but, you know, bands in those days from the South were just starting to play in New York quite a bit. And, you know, if you were that kind of band with your, you know, minimal, you know, finances, you'd stay in somebody's apartment, you know. So he told them about my place, which had just opened up. And, you know, back then there was a sort of thing of studios not really catering to the new bands like them. You know, there was a just an atmosphere thing that they wanted, because, you know, they could easily go over to Atlanta and record at any number of top studios, but they didn't want to do that. Probably partly financial, of course, but also there was just this, you know, there was that new wave thing. You know, there was this demarcation where you on this side or that side of things, you know, and the old studios tended to be thought of with music that wasn't cool anymore, you know, to these bands. So I think that's between that and you know, low finances is how I, you know, got the gig, so to speak.
And the first single that you produced was Radio Free Europe and recorded at Drive-In Studio here in Winston.
Yeah.
Is that still around? Does that place still exist?
No, but the house, you know, it was in a house. It was a garage part of a house, and the house was sold. And after some years, the guy who bought it found out about its, you know, noted legacy and got in touch. And that was pretty cool that he appreciates its, you know, major contribution to the history of recorded sound.
and so the house still stands, though. People can drive by and get their picture in front of it.
Yeah, there's a picture of that house that circulates. You could probably find it.
All right. Good to know. All right, let's talk a bit about Chronic Town, co-produced by Mitch Easter and REM. When you co-produce with the band, Mitch, it seems like you're outnumbered 4-1. How do you have any say in this?
Well, as I like to say, I was never interested in being a record producer, you know, in this sort of Svengali mold of it. I don't think I have the, you know, brains to do that anyway. I just like to work with the band, you know. So, I mean, nothing was formal. And, you know, I was the one that knew more about recording, and I was probably suggesting some things to them they hadn't thought of. But I was perfectly happy to let them do their thing. You know, I think there was this thing that, and it probably is true with some people, but not too many record producers really do this thing of like, okay, kid, you got some talent. Now we're going to send you off to the, you know, learn how to dance. You know, I don't think there really wasn't much of that in rock music ever, but there is a little bit of it, I guess, left over from, you know, I don't know, the 40s. But I mean, you know, it's just mainly we just got in there and we just made a record. Everybody talked, everybody said stuff, and we just did something. You know, it's so loose that I can't assign roles to anybody. You know, some band members are more concerned about this and some band members are concerned about that. That's all legitimate. You know, my job was just to get it recorded. And I said, here, try this guitar and stuff like that. You know, very informal.
All right. Nice. Like you guys, I was lucky enough to, I was sent a copy of this and I've played it on my turntable. And I will tell people listening that it does to now look, I'm just a fan. I don't know all the ins and outs like you two guys, but for me, it sounded sweet is what I'll say.
Yeah.
And, the song 1 Million, I just love Bill's drumming on this one. I mean, it's just fantastic. Just love it.
Bill's the guy, you know, he's great.
Yeah.
Everybody in that band was crucial.
I was going to ask if there was one unsung hero in the band, but
I think they're all sort of sung. I mean, maybe Bill gets a little less attention, you know, because he's not the lead singer, but I mean, he's great. And, you know, as we have noted, talking about these first LPs, Bill actually sang a lot on that Murmur record. And then I believe it's Don Dixon who noticed he didn't sing at all on Reckoning, which I kind of forgot. But his vocals on Murmur are really good, you know, he was a writer too. All of them wrote the songs, you know, and some more or less together, sort of apart at times, but they all did everything to some extent.
All right, let's move on to Murmur. Don Dixon, you co-produced this one with Mitch. How does co-producing work then when you guys are, I mean, you have to be on the same page. And if you're not, how do you get past that?
We would take long walks. Actually, we did walk a lot. We would take a break because Mitch was a good influence on me. He would force me to stop and we'd walk around the block there at Reflection. It was a city studio in Charlotte. And we just quietly walked. But Mitch and I have known each other a long time and even by then had known each other for a long time. And like he said earlier, the roles just aren't that defined ever. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, oh, what sounds good? And we were just sort of riding herd on this band. And Mitch brought me in out of kindness more than anything else. Kindness for an old guy who was in his 30s, who floundering and had lost his way.
That's right. I was worried, what's going to become of this guy, you know? He needs a break.
You pulled him out of it, and here he's with us today still.
Yep. Barely alive.
Now, this is a difficult question to answer, I'm sure, Mitch, but Did you have any idea what would become of REM at this point? I know it's impossible, but did you feel in your bones like, you know what, these guys could be something?
You know, I think I was, I assumed that was about a 1 in a trillion chance by the time I was like 15, you know, so I didn't really think that, but I did think they're good. And I did notice that people really like them in this exceptional way. I mean, from the story that I've told a million times is that I went to see XTC in Athens right after I first met them, and REM was opening. So it's the first time I got to see REM play live, but I had recorded them, you know, already. The single. And the people in the audience knew the words to their songs, and they didn't have access to recorded versions. They had learned those songs from going to see them every time they could, I guess, you know. I'd never seen that before, and I haven't seen it since either. You know, that was something. So that made me think something's different about these guys, you know. And, I mean, they were great, you know, and they definitely had a lot of charisma, but we've seen other bands that have all that, and they just vanish. But everything worked, you know, starting with what they did, but starting with strange external circumstances where the people were in the mood for what they did, you know, it just,
yeah,
it was fantastic. But when we were recording that, I wasn't thinking like, we know anything about sales whatsoever. We are both focused on the task. Like, do we like these sounds? And that's about it.
Don, how long had it been since you had listened to Murmur top to bottom?
Oh, years and years, to be honest with you. I couldn't even, any number I would give you would be a patent lie. I won't lie to you, but it was in the years category, could be decades category, probably years, because we did work on a remastered CD version sometime in the last 15 years.
All right.
I was just going to say, one of the things that there was a sort of, I guess, a nexus for them with college radio was just coming of age and just getting organized in a way that you could have a chart and you could have this sort of unilateral impact on college radio in a way that prior to that it was always piecemeal and town by town and city by city and college by college. So I think that played some into their success.
And there was this sort of scarcity, right? I mean, people were really looking for something like this, you know, and there was so much, I don't know why it meant so much, but, you know, I drove to New York from Chapel Hill to get the God Save the Queen single, which they still had at Bleecker Bob's because EMI had stopped making them because the women in the pressing plant refused to work on that record, which was a great story. And I thought, well, I need one of these, you know. So, I mean, of course, I was, you know, a kid, but the fact that I would make that effort is inexplicable. But I wasn't the only person doing stuff like that to get that music. You know, what they saw was that music. And it didn't take a lot, you know, for something to catch on because people were, it's really funny about these big cultural changes, you know. You just have to think, okay, what if REM had come out 2 years earlier? You know, probably nothing would have happened. I mean, it's just weird about all that.
Yeah, it's a moment in time, and you just have to be there right at that specific point.
Yeah, and it's not, again, not to take anything away from what they do. It's just the big picture is very important. I mean, this is why, like, bands need the audience to, like, do something when they play live, you know, and when they do, the show will be a whole lot better. You know, the whole thing adds up in that sort of cosmic way, really is what makes it happen.
Mitch, when you listen to Murmur this time, did anything jump out at you? Did you notice anything that you hadn't heard before?
No, but I mean, okay. If you mean on these records, it was just like, well, yeah. I'm hearing that little tiny thing very well now. You know, there is a sense of detail about this record, and it's interesting because it's not, you know, the old thing of remasters usually meant that they kind of revved up the top end. You know, records tend to be brighter than these, but it's not like that on this. It's like there's just a true clarity top to bottom. You know, the low end is really nice on these records. It's every frequency range is good. So maybe I heard things a little more out front, you know, than I'd heard maybe since the last time we played that master tape in 1982 or whenever it was, you know, but yeah, you know, but I mean, I have heard these records enough that I do remember them pretty well, but I'm also like Don there, I don't play them. You know, there are a lot of records that I care about that I like to play, like really not often, so that when I do play them, it's a real experience again, you know. And that is true. If I wait a while and I play it, then it's always kind of amazing all over again, and I love that. So, you know. But anyway, yeah. No, I didn't hear anything new. I just heard Clarity.
Clarity. Okay. Don, for Murmur, were all the songs written before you guys started to record, or were some tracks written in the studio?
I can't think of anything that would have been written in the studio. Mm-hmm. Michael kept the lyrics kind of close to his chest, and he may have been tweaking words for all we know. But you know, I think the band came in with the songs they were playing live and the ones they wanted to, they felt like they knew, you know, and sounded good. And we just sort of worked with what they gave us.
All right.
Mitch.
And Mitch, was there a reason why Radio Free Europe was re-recorded for Murmur? Not happy with the original one? Did they think they could do it better? Did you think
No, they weren't happy with the original one. You know, there's the famous story of the Hibtone single and the mix that was done for that and all that, which they didn't like, you know. But beyond that, I think IRS liked the song and thought it was kind of like a hit, you know, a very easy to grasp kind of song, because it is, you know. And it's a very catchy song, right? So I think they just wanted it to be done again in a fancier studio with fanciness, you know. That's why it was redone.
With fancier fanciness.
Yeah. Okay. That's mainly what you get. You know, they were very concerned about that. You know, they insisted that the recording be done on a 24 track recorder as opposed to 16, because, you know, more tracks.
Yeah.
So, you know, more good. That was
more good.
You know, I'm being a little snide about this because there's a lot of misconceptions about what makes stuff actually sound good. But, you know, they just wanted to make a very competitive kind of record. And they thought that we should do what everybody else did, kind of, you know.
Well, you did it. You did it. Back in the day, the album went gold. Has it achieved platinum status by this point?
I don't know. They're probably keeping that from us. Actually, it must have. I mean, it still sells.
I feel like, yeah. You guys don't have platinum records. Do you have gold records from it?
I have a gold record.
All right.
Yeah. And a gold cassette.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I think mine has mine might be on the wall back here. Yes, it does have the cassette and the CD. Ooh. And the album on it, even though it was not originally a CD, I don't think.
Yeah, no, it was years before they had the CD version. I mean, not many years, but a few.
I'm glad you have that hanging up, Don. I talk to a lot of people and I ask them about their gold and platinum awards. And there's some people that say, I don't even know where they are. Oh, they're in the garage in a box. I'm like, what? Why?
Well, why I don't know where most of mine are, but I do happen to have this one. This one survived the IRS attack on my former manager's office. So.
All right. And IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS, the record label?
Well, the Irish Resistance.
Okay. All right.
I might have been FBI. I don't know. It was some sort of, but FBI, that could be them too, right?
Yeah, true.
What were their companies? IRS, FBI, LAPD. Was there another one?
I don't remember LAPD, but I believe you.
LAPD was Los Angeles Personal Development.
Oh, wow.
And it was Miles' brother. What was his brother's name?
Miles Copeland. Yeah. Stuart Copeland, and then there was another brother, but I can't
remember. Yeah, and the other brother had the
Ian.
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 Yeah. I think that was his company was LAPD.
Okay.
They were all leaning in on that police name.
And what did the FBI stand for? Oh,
Frontier Booking International. And, it, you know, it came from the Copeland's dad. You know about that, right? He was.
Right. Yeah, yeah. He was, I think, wasn't Miles, like, born in Egypt or someplace?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I love jogging the memory. It keeps us young. Track 2 on Murmur, Pilgrimage. This is one of my favorite tracks. I really love it. Mitch, do you have a favorite track? And I know they're all your babies, but do you have a favorite track on this album?
I'm kind of with you on that one. I mean, I think that's a good record, but I do really love Pilgrimage, partly because, you know, it was our audition track, you know, for me and Dixon, you know, to see if we could cut the mustard with the label. And we went down to Reflection to do that on 24 tracks. And I just thought it was such a great session because, you know, we did the whole thing in one day, including the mix. IRS did not particularly like it. And the band insisted, and it came out anyway, and I still love it, you know, and I think history has shown that we're right. It's a good track, you know, and it was just so great to finish the thing in one day. And then we came back to do the album because, again, the band insisted, bless their hearts, and we didn't remix it or anything because we love it, you know. So a lot of people would automatically remix it, of course, you know, but we just thought, why mess with perfection, you know?
Right.
So we didn't.
Tape is expensive.
That's right. You don't waste that.
How would we waste additional tape?
Yep. Yeah. These were the punk years. You know, everything has got to be quick. None of that nonsense, right? None of that 4 months to cut the drum tracks bullshit. You know, everybody was really into this punk ethos. And it was IRS's, you know, to their credit that they kind of pushed that too. But also it was a great way to not spend a lot of money and have bigger profits. You know, it was all working very well, you know, and it fit with the way REM thought too.
The song Perfect Circle features a couple guys, Don on bass guitar, this is what the credits say, and Mitch on backwards guitar.
Pull your dress on, stay real close. Who might leave you where I left off? Circle of acquaintances and friends. Drink another coin of praise. Heaven assumes shoulders high in the room.
Don, were you playing bass along with Mike, or were you, or was Mike not on that track? How does this work?
Mike is playing piano.
Okay.
I played a bass part to a drum loop we created. That was the rhythmic essence of that song. A drum loop out of Bill's playing.
Okay.
But it was a real loop, a big long loop tape. And we put that down and then I put bass on. Mitch did some, you probably did more than a backwards guitar on that, Mitch.
I think I did play acoustic guitar on it too, but yeah, that was one of the, you asked about writing at the studio. That was probably transformed a lot in the studio because they did that on stage with a little tiny Casio keyboard, and which I think maybe Bill played and then Michael sang, and that was it, you know? So it was kind of great live, because but it, the skeletal way they did it would not have exactly been a compelling recording, we thought. So we fleshed it out, and it took a little bit of salesmanship, so to speak, to get the band on board with the deluxe version. But I think it's really kind of beautiful, and you know,
it is. It's Mike and Bill Berry both playing piano at the same time.
Yeah, because Reflection had, you know, a really nice piano, and then they had the barroom piano, you know, that was set up with the hard hammers and everything. And those two pianos together just sounded so good. So those guys did play at the same time. And the drum loop was really just meant to be kind of like a click track, but then it, like, that's it, that would work. That became the way to do that song. And it got to stay, you know, as part of the mix. Although it gets turned off a couple of times, but it's just always going.
Right.
Well, I like all the accolades for Mike and Bill, because so often in bands, it's the singer and then it's the guitar player, and the other guys are whoever they are. But, you know, and but everyone in this band is fantastic.
Well, they, like Mitch said earlier, that all four of these guys were like the Beatles. You really could not pull one of them out and have the same dynamic.
Yeah.
Or the same sonics, even. The same sound. Yeah. And I don't think Peter Buck gets enough credit for being a really different and machine-like monster of a guitar player.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got a lot of sort of crap from the old guard back then, you know, because there were no screaming guitar solos, which, you know, the fact that that actually concerned anybody then just struck me. It's like, are you kidding? You know, but people would say stuff like that. But again, history has proven him. And, you know, he was just perfect at doing the things that are, that you hear on those records, and very little fixing on anybody. You know, I mean, it was amazing, actually.
And track 8, Sitting Still, I mean, that's got some jangly guitar that I just love. I mean, it's fantastic.
His name of God, we are could stop it worried. We could bind it in the sieve. We could gather, throw a fit. Up to Paul Katie, bars and kitchen signs, but not me.
I don't know how you feel about the term jangly guitar, but that's my go-to.
It's an inescapable term, and I guess it fits. You know, it used to be a backhanded compliment at best, but I think now it's not. You know, I think it's just pure description, and I suppose it fits because it certainly isn't power chords. So, yeah.
I'm just trying to remember Sitting Still. The sounds, it's got
a 12 string on it, you know, so that sort of lifts it a bit, you know, in that direction.
Yeah.
Is it your Fender?
Yeah.
Do you still have that guitar?
No, stolen. I haven't had much stuff stolen, but that one was stolen, and that one hurt, you know. It was like, I got that one when I was 12, I think, you know, and I forced a lot of bands to use it, and I'm glad I did. You know, it's good instrument, but I don't have it.
So where was it stolen from? How does this happen?
Well, if you must know, it was stolen right out of our recording studio here when I was out of town. Other people were working here, and I think maybe it was a semi-inside job, like somebody knew one of these bands, and because some other band's stuff got stolen too. It was right before a session started. And I think maybe somebody didn't lock the door. I don't know. It's very weird. I was in California, so I didn't exactly see any of this happen.
All right. Well, if anyone out there knows where this guitar is, please return it to Mitchie Easter.
Thank you. You know, I saw one in Nashville this summer that I thought, could that be it? It was the same era, about the same degree of wear, but it wasn't, because I surreptitiously took a picture of its serial number. So unless somebody made a really good fake serial number plate, it wasn't my guitar.
Okay, so if someone found this, would you be able to authenticate it that it is your guitar? Do you have any documentation that it's your guitar?
Well, I have the serial number, you know, and I remember some of its dings and everything like that. But I mean, it's been gone for a long time. So it's, you know, it could be in another continent by now. And I've had a checkered career that I'll never know about.
Anything can happen.
Yeah. But then you always hear about, you know, George Harrison gets a guitar back, you know, 30 years later. But there are more people looking out for George probably than
maybe. Don, do you have a favorite song on Murmur?
Song or recording?
What now? What's the difference there?
Was a huge difference.
Well, you tell me.
Song is a song. A song can be recorded 40 different times and have 40 different fabulous versions that aren't all the same thing. I think my favorite recording is also Pilgrimage.
All right.
There's something that sounds particularly great about that one. Pilgrimage is not my favorite song, though. I'm not sure which song would be my favorite song.
But your favorite recording is Pilgrimage.
My favorite recording on that is I'm not sure. Do you have a favorite song, Mitch?
Well, I started Pilgrimage, but kind of in that same way. I mean, it's a mixture of the recording and my memory of it and all, but I do like the song, but
That 9 to 9 is the most interesting song on the record.
Well, it's like no other. It's like no other they ever did again, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think anyone could do that again.
You know, you might be interested, Pat, that we tried to do that for Chronic Town and the band got confused by it, you know, but I do have the attempt, which is pretty good, but I think they were kind of on different planets, you know, and they were maybe on different planets on the one on Murmur, but at least they all ended at the same time. You know, that is a weird song rhythmically.
Yes.
But it's cool. It's really cool.
It is cool. Yeah. And it's also track 9 on the CD. So a bunch of 9s.
Oh, good point.
So you both also co-produced the band's next album, Reckoning. Is there any talk that that album could be getting the Definitive Sound Series treatment?
I don't know.
I don't think they can afford that one until the records are $250.
Well, people will pay it for sure.
So, you know, I mean, this is a lot of money for that, but are you aware of these reel-to-reel tapes that are being made now? You know, just like in the 60s, you know, there was a reel-to-reel tape scene. I think Rhino is doing them, and they are $299. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. That seems like a bridge too far, you know. But, I mean, they haven't proven that nobody will buy them, so maybe people will buy them.
Yeah, I think one of the first releases on that is one of the Yes albums. I'm not sure which one, but, yeah, I was shocked when I saw that. Reel-to-reel is coming back.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, you know, if it was a struggle to have people have functional record players, it's a lot bigger struggle for them to have functional tape machines at this point. But you may know there are two brand new ones that have come to market and they cost nearly $20,000, you know, like as much as a pro machine costs, you know, and then some. But, you know, people just throw around billions these days, don't they? So I can't grasp any of this, actually.
No, I can't grasp it either.
We also want to remember that during the height of reel-to-reel sales, they were never very successful.
They weren't. And the record companies seemed to make really minimal effort to make those tape boxes look like anything. They just were terrible. Right. You know, I mean, because when I see those in thrift stores and stuff, I buy them because they're just kind of fun to hear. The main thing that's cool about reel-to-reel tapes for me, as now speaking as a 10-year-old, is that the stereo separation is more on a tape machine than a record can do. So that's really fun on those weirdo early mixes of rock bands like the old Beatles records that are in stereo, where they just simply had no idea what to do with those two channels, and they did some really weird things. So you could turn the pan control to one side or the other and hear like the vocals completely by themselves or something, which was fascinating to me in the fourth grade. But beyond that, there's no point in these reel-to-reel tapes, really. They don't know. That's not for me to muse on any further. But I love the master tapes. I just don't really care about this, you know.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That Enoch White appreciated the separation.
Yeah.
I want to talk about one of my favorite artists of all time. He's been on this show, I think, four times currently, Marshall Crenshaw. I know you've both worked with him. Let's talk with Mitch first. You co-produced the song Blues is King on the album Downtown. Was there any talk of you producing a full Marshall Crenshaw album?
I don't think so, but I love that Blues is King version, and I'm so happy that it wound up on the album, because I know they did recut it for that record, but they used our version. And our version was just like Pilgrimage. We did it all at Reflection in a day, including the mix. And I thought, this is a trend that I hope to continue and have failed to continue since then. But it was so great to do that, you know? I was sort of like, you know, my glimpse of being a recording person in 1962, you know, which probably was a really fun time to be making records. And, I did record Marshall on a few occasions, but they were more like experimental. Like, he came to my place in the old garage days and did some stuff with his brother. And, it was kind of cool, but it wasn't, you know, ever used for anything.
And then Don, you produced one of my favorites, Mary Jean and Nine Others. I love this album, and the song that you co-wrote with Marshall, Calling Out for Love at Crying Time, is just fantastic.
She was kicking down the fence, trying to hide the evidence that would give her game away.
Thank you. I like all of the above. And Mr. Easter flew up to Bearsville to play guitar on the live to two-track version of
Steel Strings.
Steel Strings. Yep. And kills it. Well, I'm trying not to use those kinds of things. And performs quite well.
You could hear him play with shaky hands, guitar strung up with rubber bands, singing, do you want a man of steel? Oh, do you want a
Yeah. So just a shout out to you guys with your collaborations with Marshall Crenshaw, who I just saw this earlier or later in 2025 when he played here. He played in the area. So he's still out there.
Yeah, I saw him in D.C. in March. I mean, in October or November. I can't remember, but late. It was fun.
Yeah.
He has a good combo. Who's that guy that plays? Is the guy, it's the guy, what was the band he was touring with for a while?
He was it the Bottle Rockets?
Bottle Rockets, right. Yeah. So the guitar player, I think, is still from the guy from the Bottle
Rockets. The drummer is still from the Bottle Rockets.
Okay.
And then he's got Fernando Perdomo on guitar.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, I can't remember the bass player's name. He's really good. He's got a couple records of his own.
It's a guy from L.A.
Yeah. Oh, that's really bumming me out. But anyway, I've discussed him on the show before, too. So now, look, both of you, fantastic job on this record in its original form. Thank you for coming out and singing its praises in 2026. And hopefully they do some more of these REM albums. But let's do Reckoning first so you guys can get some more quarters in your mailbox.
I'm for it.
With that, I need a play out song from this album. Can't be Pilgrimage. Let's do another one. Let's talk about another one. Which of you wants to choose the play out song for this episode?
Mitch. My mind goes blank at these kind of questions. Like, what are the other songs on that record?
Oh, boy. Okay, here we go. Laughing, Talk About the Passion, Catapult, Shaking Through, We Walk.
I always like Catapult.
I love Catapult. Catapult.
Too. Done deal. So, Don Dixon, Mitch Easter, thank you so much for your time. And everyone, go buy this album before it sells out. 3,000, that's not many. And please enjoy Catapult. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Don, get better.
I'm going to try.
All right. And Mitch, my day job is I'm a crew member at Trader Joe's. So we will meet in person.
Oh, killer. Yeah. All right.
I'll see you and I'll find you.
Okay, cool.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye. I can come. Bye.